content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. This week, I will continue with our series on the short stories published by J.D. Salinger in the New Yorker magazine. I will read part one of the 11th of 13 short stories published by J.D. Salinger in the New Yorker, published in the May 4th, 1957 edition, Zoe, by J.D. Salinger. The facts at hand presumably speak for themselves, but a trifle more vulgarly, I suspect, than facts even usually do. As a counterbalance, then, we begin with that ever-fresh and exciting odium, the author's formal introduction. The one I have in mind not only is wordy and earnest beyond my wildest dreams, but is, to boot, rather excruciatingly personal. If, with the right kind of luck, it comes off, it should be comparable, in effect, to a compulsory guided tour through the engine room, with myself as guide, leading the way in an old one-piece Janssen bathing suit. To get straight to the worst, what I'm about to offer isn't really a short story at all, but a sort of prose home movie, and those who have seen the footage have strongly advised me against nurturing any elaborate distribution plans for it. The dissenting group, it's my privilege and headache to divulge, consists of the three featured players themselves, two female, one male. We'll take the leading lady first, who, I believe, would prefer to be briefly described as a languid, sophisticated type. She feels that things might have gone along well enough if I'd just done something about a 15 or 20 minute scene in which she blows her nose several times, snipped it out, I gather. She says it's disgusting to watch somebody keep blowing her nose. The other lady of the ensemble, a svelte twilight soubrette, objects to my having, so to speak, photographed her in her old housecoat. Neither of these two lovelies, as they've hinted they'd like to be called, takes any very shrill exception to my overall exploitive purposes. For a terribly simple reason, really. If, to me, a somewhat reddening one, they know from experience that I burst into tears at the first harsh or remonstrative word. It's the leading man, however, who has made the most eloquent appeal to me to call off the production. He feels that the plot hinges on mysticism or religious mystification. In any case, he makes it very clear, a too vividly apparent transcendent element of sorts, which he says he's worried can only expedite, move up, the day and hour of my professional undoing. People are already shaking their heads over me, and any immediate further professional use on my part of the word God, except as a familiar, healthy American expletive, will be taken, or rather confirmed, as the very worst kind of name-dropping and a sure sign that I'm going straight to the dogs. Which is, of course, something to give any normal faint-hearted man, and particularly writing man, pause. And it does, but only pause. For a point of objection, however, eloquent is only as good as it is applicable. The fact is, I've been producing prose home movies off and on since I was 15. Somewhere in The Great Gatsby, which was my Tom Sawyer when I was 12, the youthful narrator remarks that everybody suspects himself of having at least one of the cardinal virtues, as he goes on to say that he thinks his, bless his heart, is honesty. Mine, I think, is that I know the difference between a mystical story and a love story. I say that my current offering isn't a mystical story or a religiously mystifying story at all. I say it's a compound or multiple love story, pure and complicated. The plot line itself, to finish up, is largely the result of a rather unholy collaborative effort. Almost all the facts to follow, slowly, calmly to follow, were originally given to me in hideously spaced installments and in to me, somewhat harrowingly private sittings by the three player characters themselves. Not one of the three, I might well add, showed any noticeably soaring talent for brevity or detail or compression of incident. A shortcoming, I'm afraid, that will be carried over to this, the final or shooting version. I can't excuse it, regrettably, but I insist on trying to explain it. We are, all four of us, blood relatives, and we speak a kind of esoteric family language, a sort of semantic geometry, in which the shortest distance between any two points is a foolish circle. One last advisory word. Our family surname is Glass. In just a moment, the youngest Glass boy will be seen reading an exceedingly lengthy letter, which will be reprinted here in full, I can safely promise, sent to him by his eldest living brother, Buddy Glass. The style of the letter, I'm told, bears a considerably more than passing resemblance to the style or written mannerisms of this narrator, and the general reader will no doubt jump to the heady conclusion that the writer of the letter and I are one and the same person. Jump he will, and I'm afraid jump he should. We will, however, leave this Buddy Glass in the third person from here on in. At least, I see no good reason to take him out of it. 10:30 on a Monday morning in November of 1955, Zoe Glass, a young man of 25, was seated in a very full bath reading a four-year-old letter. It was an almost endless-looking letter, typewritten on several pages of second-sheet yellow paper, and he was having some little trouble keeping it propped up against the two dry islands of his knees. At his right, a dampish-looking cigarette was balanced on the edge of the built-in enamel soap catch, and evidently it was burning well enough, for every now and then he picked it off and took a drag or two, without quite having to look up from his letter. His ashes invariably fell into the tub water, either straightway or down one of the letter pages. He seemed unaware of the messiness of the arrangement. He did seem aware, though, it only just, that the heat of the water was beginning to have a dehydrating effect on him. The longer he sat reading or rereading, the more often and the less absently he used the back of his wrist to blot his forehead and upper lip. In Zoe, be assured early, we are dealing with the complex, the overlapping, the cloven, and at least two dossier-like paragraphs ought to be got in right here. To start with, he was a small young man and extremely slight of body. From the rear, particularly where his vertebrae were visible, he might almost have passed for one of those needy metropolitan children who are sent out every summer to endowed camps to be fattened and sunned. Close up, either full face or in profile, he was surpassingly handsome, even spectacularly so. His eldest sister, who modestly prefers to be identified here as a Tuckahoe homemaker, has asked me to describe him as looking like, quote, the blue-eyed Jewish-Irish Mohican scout who died in your arms at the roulette table at Monte Carlo, end quote. A more general and surely less parochial view was that his face had been just barely saved from too handsomeness, not to say gorgeousness, by virtue of one ear's protruding slightly more than the other. I myself hold a very different opinion from either of those. I submit that Zoe's face was close to being a wholly beautiful face. As such, it was, of course, vulnerable to the same variety of glibly undaunted and usually specious evaluations that any legitimate art object is. I think it just remains to be said that any one of 100 every day menaces, a car accident, a head cold, a lie before breakfast, could have disfigured or coarsened his bounteous good looks in a day or a second. But what was undiminishable, and, as already so flatly suggested, a joy of a kind forever, was an authentic esprit superimposed over his entire face, especially at the eyes, where it was often as arresting as a harlequin mask and, on occasion, much more confounding. by profession, Zoe was an actor, a leading man in television, and had been for a little more than 3 years. He was, in fact, as sought after, and according to vague second-hand reports that reached his family, as highly paid, as a young leading man in television perhaps can be, who isn't at the same time a Hollywood or Broadway star with a ready-made national reputation. But possibly either of these statements, without elaboration, can lead to an overly clear-cut line of conjecture. As it happened, Zoe had made a formal and serious debut as a public performer at the age of 7. He was the second youngest of what had originally been 7 brothers and sisters, 5 boys and 2 girls, all of whom, at rather conveniently spaced intervals during childhood, had been heard regularly on a network radio program, a children's quiz show called It's a Wise Child. An age difference of 18 years between the eldest of the Glass children, Seymour, and the youngest, Franny, had helped very considerably to allow the family to reserve a kind of dynastic seating arrangement at the Wise Child microphones, which lasted just over 16 years, from 1927 well into 1943, a span of years connecting the Charleston and B-17 eras. All this data, I think, is to some degree relevant. For all the gaps in years between their individual heydays on the program, it may be said, with few and no really important reservations, that all 7 of the children had managed to answer over the air a prodigious number of alternately deadly bookish and deadly cute questions sent in by listeners with a freshness and a plume that was considered unique in commercial radio. Public response to the children was often hot and never tepid. In general, listeners were divided into 2 curiously restive camps: those who held that the Glasses were a bunch of insufferably superior little bastards that should have been drowned or gassed at birth, and those who held that they were bona fide underage wits and savants of an uncommon, if unenviable, order. At this writing, 1957, there are former listeners to It's a Wise Child who remember, with basically astonishing accuracy, many of the individual performances of each of the 7 children. In this same thinning but still oddly coterie-like group, the consensus is that of all the Glass children, the eldest boy, Seymour, back in the late 20s and early 30s, had been the best to hear, the most consistently rewarding. After Seymour, Zoe, the youngest boy in the family, is generally placed second in order of preference or appeal. And since we have a singularly workaday interest in Zoe here, it may be appended that, as an ex-panelist on It's a Wise Child, he had one almanac-like distinction among or over his brothers and sisters. Off and on, during their broadcasting years, all 7 of the children had been fair game for the kind of child psychologist or professional educator who takes a special interest in extra precocious children. In this cause or service, Zoe had been, of all the Glasses, hands down the most voraciously examined, interviewed, and poked at. Very notably, with no exceptions that I know of, his experiences in the apparently divergent fields of clinical, social, and newsstand psychology had been costly for him. As though the places where he was examined had been uniformly alive with either highly contagious traumas or just plain old-fashioned germs. For example, in 1942, with the everlasting disapproval of his 2 eldest brothers, both of whom were in the Army at the time, he had been tested by 1 research group alone in Boston on 5 separate occasions. He was 12 during most of the sessions, and it's possible that the train rides, 10 of them, held some attraction for him, at least in the beginning. The main purpose of the 5 tests, one gathered, was to isolate and study, if possible, the source of Zoe's precocious wit and fancy. At the end of the 5th test, the subject was sent home to New York with 3 or 4 aspirins in an engraved envelope for his sniffles, which turned out to be bronchial pneumonia. Some 6 weeks later, a long-distance call came through from Boston at 11:30 at night, with much dropping of small coins in an ordinary payphone and an unidentified voice, with no intention, presumably, of sounding pedantically waggish, informed Mr. and Mrs. Glass that their son Zoe at 12 had an English vocabulary on an exact par with Mary Baker Eddy's, if he could be urged to use it. To resume, the long typewritten 4-year-old letter that Zoe had checked into the bathtub with on this Monday morning in November 1st, 1955, had obviously been taken out of its envelope and unfolded and refolded on too many private occasions during the 4 years, so that now it not only had an overall unappetitlich appearance, but was actually torn in several places, mostly along the creases. The author of the letter, as stated earlier, was Zoe's eldest living brother, Buddy. The letter itself was virtually endless in length, overwritten, teaching, repetitious, opinionated, remonstrative, condescending, embarrassing, and filled to a surfeit with affection. In short, it was exactly the kind of letter that a recipient, whether he wants to or not, carries around for some time in his hip pocket. And the professional writers of a type love to reproduce verbatim. And here it is. March 18, 1951. Dear Zoe, I've just finished decoding a long letter that came from Mother this morning, all about you and General Eisenhower's smile and the small boys in Daily News who fall down elevator shafts. And when am I going to have my phone in New York taken out and get one installed up here in the country where I really need it? Surely the only woman in the world who can write a letter in invisible italics. Dear Bessie, I get 500 words of copy from her like clockwork every 3 months on the subject of my poor old private phone and how stupid it is to pay good money every month for something nobody's ever even around to use anymore. Which is really a big fat lie. When I'm in town, I invariably sit talking by the hour with my old friend Yama, the god of death, and a private phone's a must for our little chats. Anyway, please tell her I haven't changed my mind. I love that old phone with a passion. It was the only really private property Seymour and I ever had in Bessie's entire kibitz. It was also essential to my inner harmony to see Seymour's listing in the goddamn phone book every year. I like to browse through the G's confidently, be a good boy and pass that message along for me. Not quite word for word, but nicely. Be kinder to Bessie, Zoe, when you can. I don't think I mean because she's our mother, but because she's weary. You will, after you're 30 or so, when everybody slows down a little, even you maybe, but try harder now. It isn't enough to treat her with the doting brutality of an Apache dancer toward his partner, which she understands, incidentally, whether you think so or not. You forget that she thrives on sentimentality almost as much as Les does. My telephone problems aside, Bessie's current letter is really a Zoe letter. I'm to write and tell you that you have your whole life before you, and that it's criminal with a capital C if you don't go after your PhD before you go in for the actor's life in a big way. She doesn't say what she'd like you to get the PhD in, but I assume math rather than Greek, you dirty little bookworm. At any rate, I gather that she wants you to have something to fall back on, if for some reason the acting career doesn't work out, which may be very sound, and probably is, but I don't feel like coming right out and saying so. It happens to be one of those days when I see everybody in the family, including myself, through the wrong end of a telescope. I actually had to struggle at the mailbox this morning to know who Bessie was when I saw her name on the return address of the envelope. For one good enough reason, Advanced Writing 24A loaded me up with 38 short stories to drag tearfully home for the weekend. 37 of them will be about a shy, reclusive Pennsylvania Dutch lesbian who wants to write, told first person by a lecherous hired hand. in dialect. I take it for granted, you know, that for all the years I've been moving my literary whore's cubicle from college to college, I still don't have even a B.A. It seems a century ago, but I think there were two reasons, originally, why I didn't take a degree. Just kindly sit still. This is the first time I've written to you in years. One, I was a proper snob in college, as only an old, wise child alumnus and future lifetime English major can be, and I didn't want any degrees if all the ill-read literates and radio announcers and pedagogical dummies I knew had them by the peck. And two, Seymour had his PhD at an age when most young Americans are just getting out of high school, and since it was too late for me to catch up with him in style, I wasn't having any of it. Of course, too, I knew for certain when I was your age that I'd never be forced to teach, that if my muses failed to provide for me, I'd go grind lenses somewhere, like Booker T. Washington. In any particular sense, though, I don't think I have any academic regrets. On especially black days, I sometimes tell myself that if I'd loaded up with degrees when I was able, I might not now be teaching anything quite so collegiate and hopeless as Advanced Writing 24A. But that's probably bunk. The cards are stacked, quite properly, I imagine, against all professional aesthetes, and no doubt we all deserve the dark, wordy academic deaths we all sooner or later die. I do think your case is a lot different from mine. Anyway, I don't think I'm really on Bessie's side. If it's security you want, or that Bessie wants for you, your MA will at least always qualify you to pass out logarithm tables at any dreary boys prep school in the country and most colleges. On the other hand, your beautiful Greek will do you almost no good at all on any good-sized campus unless you have a PhD, living as we do in a brass hat, brass mortarboard world. Of course, you can always move to Athens, sunny old Athens. But the more I think of it, the more I think to hell with more degrees for you. The fact is, if you want to know, I can't help thinking why you'd make a damn sight better adjusted actor if Seymour and I hadn't thrown in the Upanishads and the Diamond Sutra and Eckhart and all our other old loves with the rest of your recommended home reading when you were small. By rights, an actor should travel fairly light. When we were kids, S and I once had a beautiful lunch with John Barrymore. He was bright as hell and full of lore, but he wasn't burdened down with any of the cumbersome luggage of a too formal education. I mention this because I was talking to a rather pompous Orientalist over the weekend, and at one point, during a very deep metaphysical lull in the conversation, I told him I had a little brother who once got over an unhappy love affair by trying to translate the Mundaka Upanishad into classical Greek. He laughed uproariously, you know, the way Orientalists laugh. I wish to God I had some idea what will happen to you as an actor. You're a born one, certainly. Even our Bessie knows that, and surely you and Franny are the only beauties in the family. But where will you act? Have you thought about it? The movies? If so, I'm scared stiff that if you ever gain any weight, you'll be as victimized as the next young actor in contributing to the reliable Hollywood amalgam of prize fighter and mystic gunman and underprivileged child, cowhand, and man's conscience, and the rest. Will you be content with that standard box office schmaltz? Or will you dream of something a little more cosmic? Zum Beispiel, playing Pierre or André in a Technicolor production of War and Peace with stunning battlefield scenes and all the nuances of characterization left out, on the ground that they're novelistic and unphotogenic. And Anna Magnani, daringly cast as Natasha, just to keep the production classy and honest. And gorgeous incidental music by Dmitri Popkin, and all the male leads intermittently rippling their jaw muscles to show that they're under great emotional stress, and a world premiere at the Winter Garden under floodlights with Molotov and Milton Berle and Governor Dewey introducing the celebrities as they come into the theater. By celebrities, I mean, of course, old Tolstoy lovers, Senator Dirksen, Zsa Zsa Gabor, Gaylord Houser, Georgie Jessel, Charles of the Ritz. How does that sound? And if you go into the theater, will you have any illusions about that? Have you ever seen a really beautiful production of, say, The Cherry Orchard? Don't say you have. Nobody has. You may have seen inspired productions, competent productions, but never anything beautiful. Never one where Chekhov's talent is matched nuance for nuance, idiosyncrasy for idiosyncrasy, by every soul on stage. You worry hell out of me, Zoe. Forgive the pessimism, if not the sonority. But I know how much you demand from a thing, you little bastard, and I've had the hellish experience of sitting next to you at the theater. I can so clearly see you demanding something from the performing arts that just isn't residually there. For heaven's sakes, be careful. Granted, I'm off today. I keep a good neurotics calendar, and it's 3 years to the day since Seymour killed himself. Did I ever tell you what happened when I went back down to Florida to bring back the body? I wept like a slob on the plane for 5 solid hours, carefully adjusting my veil from time to time so that no one across the aisle could see me. I had a seat to myself, thank God. About 5 minutes before the plane landed, I became aware of people talking in the seat behind me. A woman was saying, with all of Back Bay, Boston, and most of Harvard Square in her voice, "And the next morning, mind you, they took a pint of pus out of that lovely young body of hers." That's all I remember hearing, but when I got off the plane a few minutes later and the bereaved widow came toward me all in Bergdorf Goodman black and I had the wrong expression on my face. I was grinning, which is exactly the way I feel today, for no really good reason. Against my better judgment, I feel certain that somewhere very near here, the first house down the road maybe, there's a good poet dying, but also somewhere very near here, somebody's having a hilarious pint of pus taken from her lovely young body, and I can't be running back and forth forever between grief and high delight. Last month, Dean Sheeter, whose name usually transports Franny when I mention it, approached me with his gracious smile and bullwhip, and I am now lecturing to the faculty, their wives, and a few oppressively deep-type undergraduates every Friday on Zen and Mahayana Buddhism, a feat I haven't a doubt that will eventually win me the Eastern Philosophy Chair in Hell. The point is, I'm now on the campus 5 days a week instead of 4, and what with my own work at nights and on weekends, I have almost no time to do any elective thinking, which is my plaintive way of saying that I do worry about you and Franny when I get a chance, but not nearly so often as I'd like to. What I'm really trying to tell you is that Bessie's letter had very little to do with my sitting down in a sea of ashtrays to write to you today. She shoots me some priority information about you and Franny every week, and I never do anything about it, so it isn't that. What brings this on is something that happened to me at the local supermarket today. I was standing at the meat counter, waiting for some rib lamb chops to be cut. A young mother and her little girl were waiting around, too. The little girl was about 4, and to pass time, she leaned her back against the glass showcase and stared up at my unshaven face. I told her she was about the prettiest little girl I'd seen all day, which made sense to her. She nodded. I said I'd bet she had a lot of boyfriends, and I got the same nod again. I asked her how many boyfriends she had. She held up 2 fingers. 2, I said. That's a lot of boyfriends. What are their names, sweetheart? Said she in a piercing voice, Bobby and Dorothy. I grabbed my lamb chops and ran. But that's exactly what brought on this letter, much more than Bessie's insistence that I write to you about PhDs in acting. That and a haiku-style poem I found in the hotel room where Seymour shot himself. It was written in pencil on the desk blotter. The little girl on the plane who turned her doll's head around to look at me. With these two things on my mind, I thought I was driving home from the supermarket, and at long last I could write to you and tell you why S and I took over your and Franny's education as early and as high-handedly as we did. We've never put it into words for you, and I think it's high time one of us did. But now I'm not so sure I can do it. The little girl at the meat counter is gone, and I can't quite see the polite face of the little doll on the plane. And the old horror of being a professional writer and the usual stench of words that goes with it is beginning to drive me out of my seat. It seems terribly important to try, though. The age differences in the family always seem to add unnecessarily and perversely to our problems. Not really between S and the twins and Boo Boo and me, but between the two twosomes of you and Franny and S and me. Seymour and I were both adults. He was even long out of college by the time you and Franny were both able to read. At that stage, we had no real urge even to push our favorite classics at the two of you. Not anyway with the same gusto that we had at the twins or Boo Boo. We knew there's no keeping a born scholar ignorant, and at heart, I think we didn't really want to. But we were nervous, even frightened, at the statistics on child pedants and academic Weisenheimers, who grow up into faculty recreation room savants. Much, much more important, though, Seymour had already begun to believe, and I agreed with him as far as I was able to see the point, that education by any name would smell as sweet and maybe much sweeter if it didn't begin with a quest for knowledge at all, but with a quest, as Zen would put it, for no knowledge. Dr. Suzuki says somewhere that to be in a state of pure consciousness, Satori, is to be with God before he said, "Let there be light." Seymour and I thought it might be a good thing to hold back this light from you and Franny, at least as far as we were able, and all the many lower and more fashionable lighting effects, the arts, sciences, classics, languages, till you were both able at least to conceive of a state of being where the mind knows the source of all light. We thought it would be wonderfully constructive to at least, that is, if our own limitations got in the way, tell you as much as we knew about the men, the saints, the arhats, the bodhisattvas, the jivanmuktas, who knew something or everything about this state of being. That is, we wanted you both to know who and what Jesus and Gautama and Lao Tzu and Shankaracharya and Hui Ning and Sri Ramakrishna, etc. were before you knew too much or anything about Homer or Shakespeare or even Blake or Whitman, let alone George Washington and his cherry tree or the definition of a peninsula or how to parse a sentence. That, anyway, was the big idea. Along with all this, I suppose I'm trying to say that I know how bitterly you resent the years when S and I were regularly conducting home seminars and the metaphysical sittings in particular. I just hope that one day, preferably when we're both blind drunk, we can talk about it. Meantime, I can only say that neither Seymour nor I ever had a notion that far back that you were going to grow up into an actor. We should have, no doubt, but we didn't. If we had, I feel certain S would have tried to do something constructive about it. Surely somewhere there must be a special prep course for Nirvana and Points East designed strictly for actors, and I think S would have found it. The paragraph should close, but I can't stop muttering. You'll wince at what comes next, but come it must. I think you know that I had the best intentions of checking in now and then after S's death to see how you and Franny were holding up. You were 18. I didn't worry about you overly, although I did hear from a gossipy little snip in one of my classes that you had a reputation in your college dorm for going off and sitting in meditation for 10 hours at a time, and that made me think. But Franny was 13 at the time. I simply couldn't move, though. I was afraid to come home. I wasn't afraid you'd both, in tears, take up a position across the room and fire the complete set of Max Mueller's sacred books of the East at me one by one, which would have been a masochistic ecstasy for me, probably. But I was afraid of the questions, much more than the accusations you might both put to me. As I remember very well, I let a whole year go by after the funeral before I came back to New York at all. After that, it was easy enough to come in for birthdays and holidays and be reasonably sure that questions would run to when my next book would be finished and had I done any skiing lately, etc. You've even both been up here on many a weekend in the last couple of years, and though we've talked and talked and talked, we've all agreed not to say a word. Today is the first time I've really wanted to speak up. The deeper I get into this goddamn letter, the more I lose the courage of my convictions. But I swear to you that I had a perfectly communicable little vision of truth, Lamb Chop Division, this afternoon, the very instant that child told me her boyfriend's names were Bobby and Dorothy. Seymour once said to me, in a crosstown bus of all places, that all legitimate religious study must lead to unlearning the differences, the illusory differences between boys and girls, animals and stones, day and night, heat and cold. That suddenly hit me at the meat counter, and it seemed a matter of life and death to drive home at 70 miles an hour to get a letter off to you. Oh, God, how I wished I'd grabbed a pencil right there in the supermarket and not trusted the roads home. Maybe it's just as well, though. There are times when I think you've forgiven S more completely than any of us. Waker once said something very interesting to me on that subject. In fact, I'm merely parroting what he said to me. He said you were the only one who was bitter about S's suicide and the only one who really forgave him for it. The rest of us, he said, were outwardly unbitter and inwardly unforgiving. That may be truer than true. How can I know? All I do know for certain is that I had something happy and exciting to tell you, and on just one side of the paper, double-spaced, and I knew when I got home that it was mostly gone, or all gone, and there was nothing left to do but go through the motions, lecture you on PhDs and the actor's life. How messy, how funny, how Seymour himself would have smiled and smiled and probably assured me and all of us not to worry about it. Enough. Act. Zachary Martin Glass, when and where you want to, since you feel you must, but do it with all your might. If you do anything at all beautiful on a stage, anything nameless and joy-making, anything above and beyond the call of theatrical ingenuity, S and I will both rent tuxedos and rhinestone hats and solemnly come around to the stage door with bouquets of snapdragons. In any case, for what little it's worth, please count on my affection and support at whatever distance. Buddy. As always, my passes at omniscience are absurd, but you, of all people, should be polite to the part of me that comes out merely clever. Years ago, in my earliest and pastiest days as a would-be writer, I once read a news story aloud to S and Boo Boo. When I was finished, Boo Boo said flatly, but looking over at Seymour, that the story was, quote, too clever, unquote. S shook his head, beaming away at me, and said cleverness was my permanent affliction, my wooden leg, and that it was in the worst possible taste to draw the group's attention to it. As one limping man to another, old Zoe, let's be courteous and kind to each other. Much love, B. The last, the under, page of the four-year-old letter was stained a sort of off-cordovan color, and it was torn in two places along the folds. Zoe finished reading, treated it with some little care as he put the letter back into page one order. He tapped the pages, to even them out, against his dry knees. He frowned. Then, mercurially, as though he'd read the letter by God for the last time in his life, He stuffed it, like so much excelsior, into its envelope. He placed the envelope on the side of the tub and began to play a little game with it. With one finger, he tapped the loaded envelope back and forth along the tub edge, seeing, apparently, if he could keep it in motion without letting it fall into the tub water. After a good 5 minutes of this, he gave the envelope a faulty tap and had to reach out quickly and grab it, which ended the game. Keeping the retrieved envelope in his hand, he sat lower, deeper in the water, letting his knees submerge. He stared abstractedly for a minute or two at the tiled wall beyond the foot of the tub, and then glanced at his cigarette on the soap catch, picked it off, and took a couple of test drags on it, but it had gone out. He sat up again, very abruptly, with a great slosh of tub water, and dropped his dry left hand over the side of the tub. A typewritten manuscript was lying, face up, on the bath mat. He picked it up and brought it aboard, as it were. He stared at it briefly, and then inserted his 4-year-old letter in the middle pages, where the stapling in a manuscript is tightest. He then propped the manuscript against his now wet knees, an inch or so above the waterline, and began to turn the pages. When he came to page 9, he folded the manuscript, magazine style, and began to read or to study. The role of Rick had been heavily underlined with a soft lead pencil. Tina, morosely.
Oh, darling, 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 I'm not much good to you, am I?
Rick. Don't say that. Don't ever say that. You hear me? Tina.
It's true, though. I'm a jinx. I'm a horrible jinx. If it hadn't been for me, Scott Kincaid would have assigned you to the Buenos Aires office ages ago. I spoiled all that.
Goes over to the window.
I'm one of the little foxes that spoil the grapes. I feel like someone in a terribly sophisticated play. The funny part is, I'm not sophisticated. I'm not anything. It's just me.
Turns.
Oh, Rick, Rick, I'm scared. What's happened to us? I can't seem to find us anymore. I reach out and reach out, and we're just not there. I'm frightened. I'm a frightened child.
Looks out the window.
I hate this rain. Sometimes I see me dead in it.
Rick, quietly. My darling, isn't that a line from A Farewell to Arms? Tina turns, furious.
Get out of here! Get out! Get out of here before I jump out of this window! Do you hear me?
Rick, grabbing her. Now you listen to me, you beautiful little moron. You adorable, childish, self-dramatizing. Zoe's reading was suddenly interrupted by his mother's voice, importunate, quasi-constructive, addressing him from outside the bathroom door.
Zoe, are you still in the tub?
Yes, I'm still in the tub. Why?
I want to come in just for a teeny minute. I have something for you.
I'm in the tub, for God's sake, Mother.
It'll just be a minute, for goodness sake. Pull the shower curtain.
Zoe took a parting look at the page he had been reading, then closed the manuscript and dropped it over the side of the tub. Jesus Christ Almighty, he said. Sometimes I see me dead in the rain. A nylon shower curtain, scarlet with a design of canary yellow sharps, flats, and clefts on it, was bunched up at the foot of the tub, attached with plastic rings to an overhead chromium bar. Sitting forward, Zoe reached for it and shot in the length of the tub, closing himself off from view.
All right, God, come in if you're coming in, he said.
His voice had no conspicuous actor's mannerisms, but it was rather excessively vibrant. It carried implacably when he had no interest in controlling it. Years earlier, as a child panelist on It's a Wise Child, he had been advised repeatedly to keep his distance from the microphone. The door opened, and Mrs. Glass, a medium stout woman in a hairnet, sidled into the bathroom. Her age, under any circumstance, was fiercely indeterminate, but never more so than when she was wearing a hairnet. Her entrances into rooms were usually verbal as well as physical.
I don't know how you can stay in the tub the way you do.
She closed the door behind her instantly, as someone does who has been waging a long, long war on behalf of her progeny against post-bath drafts. "It isn't even healthy," she said. "Do you know how long you've been in that tub?" "Exactly 45. "Don't tell me. Just don't tell me, Bessie."
"What do you mean, don't tell you?"
"Just what I said. Leave me the goddamn illusion you haven't been out there counting the minutes I've..."
"Nobody's been counting any minutes, young man," Mrs. Glass said. She was already very busy. She had brought into the bathroom a small, oblong package wrapped in white paper and tied with gold tinsel.
It appeared to contain an object roughly the size of the Hope Diamond or an irrigation attachment. Mrs. Glass narrowed her eyes at it and picked at the tinsel with her fingers. When the knot didn't give, she applied her teeth to it. She was wearing her usual at-home vesture. What her son Buddy, who was a writer and consequently, as Kafka no less has told us, not a nice man, called her pre-notification of death uniform. It consisted mostly of a hoary midnight blue Japanese kimono. She almost invariably wore it throughout the apartment during the day. With its many occultish-looking folds, it also served as a repository for the paraphernalia of a very heavy cigarette smoker and an amateur handyman. Two oversized pockets had been added at the hips, and they usually contained two or three packs of cigarettes, several match folders, a screwdriver, a claw-end hammer, a Boy Scout knife that had once belonged to one of her sons, and an enamel faucet handle or two, plus an assortment of screws, nails, hinges, and ball-bearing casters, all of which tended to make Mrs. Glass chink faintly as she moved about in her large apartment. For 10 years or more, both of her daughters had often, if impotently, conspired to throw out this veteran kimono. Her married daughter, Boo Boo, had intimated that it might have to be given a coup de grace with a blunt instrument before it was laid away in a wastebasket. However, Oriental the wrapper had originally been designed to look, it didn't detract an iota from the single, impactful impression that Mrs. Glass made on a certain type of observer. The Glasses lived in an old but categorically not unfashionable apartment house in the East 70s, where possibly two-thirds of the more mature women tenants owned fur coats and, on leaving the building on a bright weekday morning, might at least conceivably be found a half hour or so later getting in or out of one of the elevators at Lord & Taylor's or Saks or Bonwit Teller's. In this distinctly Manhattan-esque locale, Mrs. Glass was, from an undeniably hoyden point of view, a rather refreshing eyesore. She looked first as if she never, never left the building at all, but that if she did, she would be wearing a dark shawl and she would be going in the general direction of O'Connell Street, there to claim the body of one of her half-Irish, half-Jewish sons who, through some clerical error, had just been shot dead by the Black and Tans. Zoe's voice suddenly and suspiciously spoke up. "Mother, what in Christ's name are you doing out there?" Mrs. Glass had undressed the package and now stood reading the fine print on the back of a carton of toothpaste.
"Just kindly button that lip of yours," she said rather absently.
She went over to the medicine cabinet. It was stationed above the washbowl against the wall. She opened its mirror-faced door and surveyed the congested shelves with the eye, or rather the masterly squint, of a dedicated medicine cabinet gardener. Before her, in overly luxuriant rows, was a host, so to speak, of golden pharmaceuticals, plus a few technically less indigenous whatnots. The shelves bore iodine, mercurochrome vitamin capsules, dental floss, aspirin, anacin, bufferin, argyrol, mustarol, X-lax, milk of magnesia, sal hepatica, Aspergom 2 Gillette razors, 1 Schick injector razor, 2 tubes of shaving cream, a bent and somewhat torn snapshot of a fat black and white cat asleep on a porch railing, 3 combs, 2 hairbrushes, a bottle of Wild Woot hair ointment, a bottle of Fitch dandruff remover, a small unlabeled box of glycerin suppositories, Vicks nose drops, Vicks VapoWubs, 6 bars of Castile soap, the stubs of 3 tickets to a 1946 musical comedy, Call Me Mister, a tube of depilatory cream, a box of Kleenex, 2 seashells, an assortment of used-looking emery boards, 2 jars of cleansing clean, 3 pairs of scissors, a nail file, an unclouded blue marble, known to marble shooters, at least in the 20s, as a puree, a cream for contracting enlarged pores, a pair of tweezers, the strapless chassis of a girl's or women's gold wristwatch, a box of bicarbonate of soda, a girl's boarding school class ring with a chipped onyx stone, a bottle of Stop-Et, and inconceivably or no, quite a good deal more. Mrs. Glass briskly reached up and took down an object from the bottom shelf and dropped it with a muffled tinny bang into the wastebasket. "I'm putting some of that new toothpaste they're all raving about in here for you," she announced without turning around, and made good her word. "I want you to stop using that crazy powder. It's going to take all the lovely enamel off your teeth. You have lovely teeth. The least you can do is take proper..."
"Who said so?" A sound of agitated tub water came from behind the shower. "Who the hell said it's going to take all the lovely enamel off my teeth?"
"I did." Mrs. Glass gave her garden a final critical glance. "Just please use it."
She nudged an unopened box of Sol Hepatica a little with the trowel of her extended fingers to align it with the other Semper Virens in its row, and then closed the cabinet door. She turned on the cold water tap.
"I'd like to know who washes their hands and then doesn't clean the bowl up after them," she said grimly. "This is supposed to be a family of adults."
She increased the pressure of the water and cleansed the bowl briefly but thoroughly with one hand.
"I don't suppose you've spoken to your little sister yet," she said, and turned to look at the shower curtain.
"No, I have not spoken to my little sister."
"How about that getting the hell out of here now?"
"Why haven't you?" Mrs. Glass demanded. "I don't think that's nice, Zoe. I don't think that's nice at all. I asked you particularly to please go see if there's anything..."
"In the first place, Bessie, I just got up about an hour ago. In the second place, I talked to her for 2 solid hours last night, and I don't think she frankly wants to talk to any goddamn one of us today. And in the third place, if you don't get out of this bathroom, I'm going to set fire to this ugly goddamn curtain. I mean it, Bessie!"
Somewhere in the middle of these 3 illustrative points, Mrs. Glass had left off listening and sat down.
"Sometimes I could almost murder Buddy for not having a phone," she said. "It's so unnecessary. How can a grown man live like that? No phone, no anything. No one has any desire to invade his privacy if that's what he wants, but I certainly don't think it's necessary to live like a hermit."
She stirred irritably and crossed her legs.
"It isn't even safe, for heaven's sake. Suppose he broke his leg or something like that, way off in the woods like that. I worry about it all the time."
"You do, eh? What do you worry about? His breaking a leg or his not having a phone when you want him to?"
"I worry about both, young man, for your information."
"Well, Don't waste your time. You're so stupid, Bessie. Why are you so stupid? You know Buddy, for God's sake. If he were 20 miles in the woods with both legs broken and a goddamn arrow sticking out of his back, he'd crawl back to his cave just to make certain nobody sneaked in to try on his galoshes while he was out."
A short, pleasurable, if somewhat ghoulish guffaw sounded behind the curtain.
"Take my word for it, he cares too much about his goddamn privacy to die in any woods."
"Well, nobody said anything about dying," Mrs. Glass said.
She gave her hairnet a minor and needless adjustment.
"I've been trying the whole morning to get these people that live down the road from him on the phone, and they don't even answer.
It's infuriating not to be able to get him. How many times I've begged him to take that crazy phone out of his and Seymour's old room. It isn't even normal when something really comes up and he needs one. It's infuriating. I tried twice last night and about four times this. What's all this infuriating business? In the first place, why should some strangers down the road be at our beck and call? Nobody's talking about anybody being at our beck and call, Zoe. Just don't be so fresh, please. For your information, I'm very worried about that child, and I think Buddy should be told about this whole thing. Just for your information, I don't think he'd ever forgive me if I didn't get in touch with him at a time like this. All right, then. Why don't you call the college instead of bothering his neighbors? He wouldn't be in his cave anyway at this time of day. You know that. Just kindly lower that voice of yours, please, young man. Nobody's deaf. For your information, I have called the college. I've learned from experience that that does absolutely no good whatsoever. They just leave messages on his desk, and I don't think he ever goes anywhere near his office anyway. Mrs. Glass abruptly leaned her weight forward without getting up and reached out and picked up something from the top of the laundry hamper. Do you have a wash rag back there? She asked. The word is washcloth, not wash rag, and all I want, God damn it, Bessie, is to be left alone in this bathroom. That's my one simple desire. If I'd wanted this place to fill up with every fat Irish rose that passes by, I'd have said so. Now, come on, get out. Zoe, Mrs. Glass said patiently, I'm holding a clean wash rag in my hand. Do you or don't you want it? Please, just yes or no. Oh, my God, yes, 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 more than anything in the world. Throw it over. I won't throw it over. I'll hand it to you. Always throw everything in this family. Mrs. Glass got up, took three steps over to the shower curtain, and waited for a disembodied hand to claim the washcloth. Thanks a million. Clear out of here now, please. I've lost about 10 pounds already. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of the New Yorker magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and that you'll be sure and listen next time to the second part of the story, Zoe, by J.D. Salinger. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Again, that number is 919-832-5138. Well, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.